One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Today on The Grave Talks, the ghosts of Charleston's Old City Jail, a conversation with Andrew Kuhn. The Old City Jail in Charleston, South Carolina, operated from 1802 until 1939 and left behind more than just a dark legacy. Tour guide manager Andrew Kuhn discusses the jail's grisly past, including the brutal treatment of inmates, Civil War prisoners, and 19th century pirates. At the center of it all is Lavinia Fisher, believed by some to be America's first female serial killer, and whose final words still echo through the cell blocks. Visitors claim to see her spirit wandering the halls, answering from beyond the grave in chilling EVP recordings. From cold spots and disembodied whispers to full body apparitions, this place doesn't just remember its past, it relives it. Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about Charleston's Old City Jail with tour guide manager Andrew Kuhn.
First of all, just talk about a little bit of the history of the jail. The jail opened in 1802. There were jails before it in Charleston, but not to this capacity and size. And admittedly, what you see today is not what the first building looked like. And the first building, I call it the shoebox. When I give tours, that's what I refer to it as. Because the first jail was 50 by 100 feet, rectangular, two stories tall, very simple, right? Nothing, no architectural details put into it. It was just made to be a functional jail. Problem was it was massively overcrowded really from the get-go. So, even within the first couple of years, I mean, people were noticing just even how bad the conditions were. So, you know, there really was a pretty pressing need to go ahead and start expanding it and making it bigger. And through the first about 50 years, you're going to see, you know, floors being added. So it goes from two stories, eventually it'll make its way up to four stories. They're going to add what we call the octagon, which is an eight-sided extension off the back of the building. They added towers out in the front. But at the end of the day, when the whole thing was said and done, the thing was made to look like a castle. And when you pull up pictures of it, that's what it looks like, you know? But here's the thing, imagine today it's smaller. It's three stories today. But I want you to imagine a four-story building. On top of that is a two-story ventilation tower. So essentially it's gonna look like six stories. It looks like this mammoth castle, and it was made to look intimidating and scary. It wasn't something that you walked by and said, oh, that looks like a nice place to have, you know, Thanksgiving dinner or something. Like it wasn't this homely, like.
No, you know, you're right, too, because it does look super intimidating.
It does. And even today with three stories, it looks intimidating. So just imagine in its heyday when it was, you know, even bigger. It definitely looked like this gigantic structure. And with the kind of weird part about it is that you get in and you realize it's really not that big. Like it was all kind of in the image of to make it look like this idea, you know, gigantic castle. But in reality, it really wasn't as big as I think people kind of maybe think it is. So anyway, it definitely had that that look to it. And it would remain as that structure up until 1886. And in 1886, we had an earthquake hit Charleston that would have been somewhere on the like 7.3, 7.4.
Oh, wow. That was huge.
You know, very big earthquake. And that ventilation tower at the very top kind of caved in into the fourth floor. And so following that, they decided to get rid of that. They got rid. That's why it got smaller, because they got rid of the tower. They got rid of the fourth floor. And it remained as that three-story building that you see pictures of today all the way until it closes in 1939. So it ran as our jail for 137 years in Charleston. But it was more than just like a city jail. It was, like I said earlier, a county jail, a district jail. So there was a lot of people that were being held in that building on a consistent basis. And in 1939, they closed it. They had opened up another building for a jail that was going to be in operation for a few years. But nevertheless, the city, though, because preservation had already launched in Charleston, they couldn't tear it down. Now, nothing says that they had to put money to keep it up, right? So they just kind of abandoned the building and it sat out there to rot, which is one of the big reasons why damage had happened. Like it just, no love or care was put into the building after it closed, and not until about the year 2000. So.
Oh, that long.
Yeah, the only thing, there was two things the jail was used for from 1939 until about the year 2000. In that 60-ish one years, the jail was used for two things. For a short stint in the 1950s, it was used as a kindergarten.
No way.
Cannot make it up. I hand to God.
He wow. Was used as
a, they've even built a playground out in the yard of the where the old... inmates used to, you know, have to be held often. But nevertheless, the kindergarten did not last for very long. And then in the 1970s, there was an attempt to turn it into like some sort of a museum. It just, I think it was too soon for a lot of people, but also because it was in a kind of, at the time, it was in like a dangerous area. And it wasn't something in the 70s that you'd be walking down there at night to go do. So that didn't last, but very, very quickly. And so other than that, that was it. The building just kind of stayed vacated. It was, you know, for a lot of us that remember growing up in Charleston, it was that, you know, very foreboding, kind of ominous. You'd walk by it and you'd dare each other, like, I dare you to go open the door. Or if you saw an open door, to run inside, or, you know, that kind of thing, because everyone always assumed it was a haunted, creepy building. So, but yeah, it just remained empty. And then in the year, around the year 2000, was when the American College of the Building Arts, which was brand new at the time as a college, they used it as the backdrop for their education purposes. And we, within a few years after that, I think it was 2004, was when Bulldog started giving ghost tours in the evenings. And it was the school was in there for 15, 16 years before they sold it to the current company, current owners. And like I said earlier, the school moved out, and then the current owners have it. So it's now used for event space. And then we also give tours in there, continually giving tours today.
This wasn't a particularly, you know, any jail's not going to be great accommodations, but this was pretty brutal living environment, wasn't it, for the prisoners?
Absolutely. 137 years, the building never once had indoor plumbing, electricity, or running water. So the building itself, like, you know, people look at a place like this, they think jail and they think executions and torture and, you know, something with that castle look. And I'm not saying we didn't have it. We definitely did. But at the jail, but ultimately the conditions is what caused so much death. And, you know, that would have been exposure, malnutrition, suicides, but the number one killer of the building was disease.
Oh.
You know, everything from yellow fever and smallpox to malaria, cholera, typhoid, all of these things found their way into that building. And that would have been 100% the number one cause of death in that building was just from the sheer disease. So yeah, conditions, over cramped conditions. There wasn't bathrooms in the jail, you know, food was one time a day. They only had one meal per day until around 1910, 1911. And that's when they moved into a 2 meal per day system.
So for over 100 years, they got one meal a day.
One meal per day.
Wow. When you think about the cramping and everything, you know, because they didn't have the space for the number of people they had there, things would spread through there really quickly, I would think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because like take, for example, you know, talking about that there was no running water. Well, you know, you ever see the scene in the beginning of like a movie or TV show that deals with a jail and you have an inmate who comes in and they get stripped of their clothes and they get hosed down, you know, and like talc or something or powder gets thrown on them and things like that. What happened in the jail is that when the inmates came in, you know, they go through the booking process and everything like that. They get brought to the back of the building, and in the back, they literally had, like, if you read in history, they call them bathing troughs, right? So the bathing troughs, the inmates would have been standing in, and they would have been stripped down of their clothes, and they only found one well on the property, but the well water was so filthy, they were never able to drink water from it because they couldn't, it was just that dirty. And again, those waterborne diseases like typhoid and malaria, like all that would have been in that water. And they're bringing it. I mean, they're literally bringing it into the building and dumping it on inmates. So, yeah, I mean, it was aside from anyone who came in already infected with whatever. I mean, the guards, the jailers, everyone, like they were bringing these diseases sometimes. I mean, I won't say necessarily knowingly, but like, you know, they definitely came and bringing in these diseases into the building. And of course, very hard to remove them once they were there.
Impossible.
Yeah.
Impossible. And I had read that thousands of people passed away in the jail. Do you think that's correct?
I do. We don't have, like, unfortunately, I tell people on tours, I can't give you a definitive number. Like, they just don't have records of every death that ever took place in the jail. Now, have I heard kind of, I think, really extreme numbers? Of course. You know, I've heard people go, 50,000 people died in this jail. And I'm like, I think that's a little bit kind of pushing it, you know. But in my professional opinion, I'm going to say it's actually probably on the end of about 10,000.
Oh, my goodness. That's huge.
Yeah, we definitely think it was up there. Because that's, also keep in mind, though, it's 137 years, you know. So.
Right.
It's not just, it was a really quick time period. I mean, it was 137 years of misery. So absolutely, we believe that there was a significant amount of death that took place in the building.
And I was reading that there was some, and I do want to get into some specific people who were there.
Sure.
But I was reading that the first floor was set up for more gentlemanly criminals. So it depended on where you were in the prison, kind of what you did. Like the third floor was for murderers and thieves. Was it kind of separated like that?
Yes, but also keep in mind, though, that that is also time specific, right? Because remember, for the first 20 years, it's only two stories, right? So it depends on what time period you're looking at. So in the very early years, I tell people, because like the third floor, which today has been converted to that event space, is not part of what we do on the tour, but understand that even on the first floor, at one point, you had some of the worst people in Charleston being held in these spaces. But yes, as the jail kind of evolved, it was, you know, think about this. You want your worst offenders to have the hardest time escaping, right? So you're going to put them as high up as possible. In fact, the name, they actually had, you know, a lot of death rows have nicknames, right? Green Mile, right? You know, they have these nicknames in different jails for different, for death row. And in Charleston, they called it Mount Rascal. Mount Rascal was the top of the building. It was the mount you know, and rascal being a term obviously for like a criminal and ne'er-do-well, whatever you want to, you know, refer to it as. But that was where the worst of the worst were often kept. But like, because on the first floor, you know, you did have some of the, you know, more nonviolent offenders, right? Because, you know, the idea of being like, oh no, the forger escaped, you know, it's
right. Like, it's a lot different than the murderer just got out.
Yeah, the murderer or the arsonist or whatever the case may be. So like, yeah, they're definitely eventually, as the building is expanding, they're going to start taking into consideration, all right, we need to keep certain inmates together based upon not necessarily always things like race or gender or things like that, more on severity of crime. So
that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and I also read that they like were women in their own place in the jail, or was everyone kind of all together?
Yeah, again, it kind of depends on when you what time period you're looking at. Right now, you know, women were definitely held in that building, but there was never as many women as there were men.
True.
You know, you also have to consider, for a long time, it was believed that women weren't capable of heinous crimes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and if a woman was found guilty, oftentimes, oh, you know, there had to have been someone else that influenced her actions, right? So like, to see women was, I mean, it sounds a little bit kind of, I hate to use the word like stereotypical, but like, I mean, prostitution and thieves was more of what women were in the jail for than, you know, serial killers and things like that. But it's not to say that never did happen. So,
exactly. That's why I brought up women.
Exactly. And when it comes to women, though, like there was often so few that it almost didn't make sense to put them together because you were wasting space. So that's why a lot of times women were just thrown in cells with other men.
Which seems to me that would cause a whole nother set of problems.
Bingo. Yeah.
But so you didn't. The jail actually housed a very infamous female prisoner.
Yes.
And her husband.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about them? Because I've read that they consider her possibly the first serial killer.
Yeah. Yeah, Lavinia Fisher is without question the most famous ghost out of Charleston. You know, it's like Madame Lalaurie in New Orleans or whatever the case may be, right? If someone was to come to Charleston, and especially anyone who's a fanatic of the paranormal, if they have heard of any ghost of Charleston, it's Lavinia Fisher. And I grew up in Charleston, and I grew up all my whole life hearing about the legend of Lavinia. And we do know that her and her husband, John, were held as inmates at the jail. The thing about her story, though, is because it has become so widely popular, unfortunately, a lot of it has kind of evolved into legend, folklore.
Mm-hmm.
But as it always is, the facts can often be much darker than sometimes that part is. And when it came to John and Lavinia, they ran, what we do know is that they did run this building outside of the city, 6 miles outside of the city, called the 6 Mile Wayfarers House or 6 Mile Wayfarers Inn. And mile houses existed very much in that time out of cities because, you know, you don't have rest stops, right? You don't have, you know, pull-offs for gas stations and things like that. And typically the most common people who were traveling were merchants because that's their living. So they would need to have places to stop, you know, to water horses, get some rest,
right.
Eat food, whatever. And these mile houses provided a source for that. We do know that when it came to John and Lavinia, their criminal, from what we know, their criminal start kind of got in with highway robbery, right? We know they were coming down tough financially, that they were having trouble making ends meet. And so their resolve was to rob people. And what you could do is, you know, take a merchant who pulls into a bed and breakfast. They have a wagon full of goods. And if the wagon's empty, that means they've got a wagon full of cash, mm-hmm. right? You know, they've got something of value. But here's the thing. If you stole it, they don't necessarily know it's gone until they get to their destination, right? So it was kind of this great ruse that they could kind of like, you know, steal from these merchants, and then they would, you know, continue on their journey, and then they'd get to wherever their destination was and go, at some point I got robbed. And how do you, you know, in 1818 trace it down, you know? So like, it was something that worked, I think, for a while for them. But when they were caught, because as it is, you know, eventually you get caught, they were arrested for highway robbery. And at that time in Charleston, it was considered a capital offense. So they were sentenced to hang. And they were brought to the jail, and they were in the jail for 1 year. They actually, from the day of their arrest, it was exactly 1 year from their arrest to when they were executed. But so they were held in the jail for that year. And during the time at the jail, John did make an attempt at escape. They did find him the next day, so that didn't work out too well for him. He was brought back to the jail, but they would remain there until their execution. Unfortunately, I try to be as forthright with this as possible. We have no evidence of them being serial killers. Like, where there's no evidence of bodies turning up or things like that. That falls into the legend portion of it. Their crime was highway robbery. At the end of the day, that's what it was. And they were held at the jail. And so she absolutely has evolved into something you Google her, right? You Google Lavinia Fisher. She's considered America's first female serial killer. But in my opinion, and I tell people this on tour, because they didn't arrest women, because they didn't execute women, I believe there was actually kind of they believe it to be an immoral action. Like they were committing a sin by killing a woman. And I believe that there had to have been justification in what they did. And so all of a sudden they have to change the story to make it fit. So it's like, well, she was actually a serial killer and she chopped up all these bodies and dumped them in a cellar or whatever the case is. And so the whole thing of the serial killer was built on this lie at the end of the day about who she really was and what she did. So yeah, that, and when we do the tour, we don't ever want to take away what people expect. But the thing is, because we believe that she haunts the building, we don't want to upset her anymore. And I try to tell her story as accurately as I know how, because it also goes to what we were talking about earlier about her being a woman in the jail, right? And what the hell that she would have gone through just for that in of itself. So of a long explanation, but anyway, yes.
It's very interesting to me because I read several things about her, different articles, and they all kind of refer to her as the first serial killer. So was there a time where people, and it's hard to say when people went missing, but they were travelers. So you didn't know they went missing because you didn't know they were ever traveling through half the time.
Exactly. You know, that's the thing. When I've told this story before, you know, I started with before planes, trains, and automobiles, people never traveled, you know, like, you know, today, if you've, depending on where you live, you know, especially in the United States, usually you're within a drivable distance to a place that you can get to for like a mini vacation, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could take a 3-day, you know, for us, I can drive up to Myrtle Beach for a couple of days or something like that. Right. And just to get out of Charleston, right. And, you know, have some time away. No one did that. Right. No one had the wherewithal to be able to travel. So, and travel was very inefficient. And so, like I was saying earlier, like, you know, merchants were the ones who really were the ones who traveled. Politicians traveled, but like, you know, everyday people of America were born, raised, worked, and died in the same town or city their entire life. So it was very rare to kind of see a lot of people traveling and to know you like, oh yeah, like, you know, and think about it, even if you're a merchant, if you told, you know, your husband and wife or whatever the case is that you're journeying somewhere, you know, if it was 300-400 miles away, they could have been gone missing at any point.
Exactly. You know? And there was no communication. So you'd have no idea.
That's it.
For anyone to ever know that John Doe just happened to be traveling through and stayed there, they wouldn't know.
Oh, yeah, you know,
there's
sure.
No record.
Yeah, you have no idea other than the fact that they don't make their destination or they, my husband has been gone for 6 months. What are you supposed to do with that, right? Like, you know, he was supposed to be back 4 months ago or whatever the issue may have been. So, yeah, it was extremely difficult. So, you know, I mean, I'm not there. you know, as a historian, I do my best to work on when we try to piece together the truth to the story. You know, we want to look at what empirically we have in front of us to say, okay, this is what we know. You know, is it possible that they were killing people? I mean, sure, but like, we just unfortunately don't have, you know, proof. So, but she remains the legend. And, you know, we try not to take that away from people, but I am somebody who advocates for her story being told the way it is, mm-hmm. to highlight more so the horrors of the women who went through that building. So
now I did hear once again, you know, this could be legend as well, but her final words were pretty ominous, scary, yeah. almost. And but did she truly say those words?
Now I will say you hear different versions of it because that's kind of fun, but like you hear everything from she goes up to the gallows, and when they ask her if she had any last words, sometimes it's everything from, if you have a message for the devil, I will dine with him tonight. You know, if anybody has a message for the devil, I will be seeing him soon. You know, there's like little variations of it, but we have a newspaper article that was published. I don't know if it was the afternoon after they were executed or the next day, but it was within 24 hours. And what the line is in the paper was, if anyone has a message for hell, give it to me. I'll carry it.
Oh, wow.
And that would have been her last words. And now I'm going to tell you this as just my interpretation of what happened there. But, you know, because it was so rare to execute women, I don't believe that she thought that she was going to be executed, right? I mean, she actually had gone through appeals processes, right? She, you know, even when it came down, you know, as it is often when someone was executed, they have an opportunity to do their last rites, right? Or confession for the final time. And John, he went through all of that. We have records of him meeting with pastors and priests or whatever. And what Lavinia, she didn't want any of it. Because I honestly believe that she did not think that she was going to be executed because it didn't happen. It just, we don't have records of women being executed. So I think that when the hour came and she realized that it was going to happen, it was like, because of the evil that she was only, her soul was only going to head one direction. And so, which would kind of validate the words that she said. So is that true? Again, that's just my interpretation of the history. It may have been for darker reasons for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, but those absolutely, yeah, we do believe that, we all agree that her dying words, if you have a message for hell, I'll carry it.
So. And I did read that they executed her husband first.
Yep.
So then she wasn't a married woman when they executed her.
Yeah, there's a couple parts of that story that do kind of fall in that it's the telephone game of telling a story over and over again through generations that it evolves into that. You will often hear that there was a law that said you couldn't execute a married woman. We've had no such law in Charleston. The reason why John was executed first was there was only one hanging rope. So it was like, you can't hang both at the same time. And it wasn't any other reason other than, I think, I don't know if it was court ordered or necessarily, or if it was just, he was in front of her in line or they wanted to hang him and then her, but they also did not execute them at the jail. They executed them somewhere in the town. We have a hunch to know where it happened, but we don't have definitive proof, unfortunately, but we know it was not at the jail. And it was him. And then like the other thing you often hear is that she was executed in a wedding dress. Well, I mean, wedding dresses have been around, but white wedding dresses have not been around except for the last 150-ish years. So there's like, I mean, I can definitively sit, you know, tell you that there was not a white wedding dress that she is jumping off the gallows in. That also falls in that kind of telephone game too. They would have been wearing death robes. They would have been maybe in white, maybe in like a cream color, maybe even darker clothes, but they would have definitely been like death robes that they would have been put in and not a wedding dress.
You know, you've really made me feel a little bit of sympathy for her because, you know, what I'd read, serial killer, she killed all these people. Then I read what she had said. But now, you know, you just have to wonder, did she get caught up in something because of her husband? And for being executed for highway robbery really does seem like a lot.
It does.
They took that quite seriously back then.
Absolutely. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do with also like think about enforcement. It's much harder to enforce something that's 6 miles outside the city versus what's happening in the city, right? And, you know, and of course, also remember, there's a lot more kinds of crimes back then that we don't have today and whatnot, or severity and things change. But also, you know, there was no, like, you know, you committed murder. There was no 25 to life, you know. Mm-hmm. The idea of a prison system, it's going to start developing around the time of the Revolutionary War going into the early 1800s. So, I mean, this was a jail. This wasn't meant to be like, oh, your sentence is that you're going to be in the jail for 20 years and then you're going to let out. If you committed murder, you were hanged. Like, that's just what the way of the world, especially in the South. So a lot of those people convicted on those capital crimes, they were held in the jail just going through either appeals or their court process. And then after that, they're going to find their way to a gallows. So, yeah, it definitely has a different tone. And that's why we come in, people, you know, have different expectations, especially if they've heard her story. We tell it and we let people, you know, believe what you want, right? Walk out and, you know, if you want to believe whatever you're convinced, that's absolutely within. We just want to be the proper speakers for the dead, you know, and definitely wanting to tell their story because we believe they're there.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Andrew Kuhn about Charleston's Old City Jail. For more information on tours, visit bulldogtours.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes without commercials, then become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us here at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at cosi.org.